Thank you very much, Asaf. I'm sorry that we can't see each other, but I guess we can proceed on this basis. I have a difficult task here. This is an overview history of Israel, covering 150 years and 150 pages. So I feel a little diffident with this particular audience. I'm not sure that I'll be able to tell you anything that's really new. What I decided to do was to offer seven general themes from the book. These are very broad brushstrokes and do not do justice to the detail. But in doing this, I'm going to let the chips fall where they may, and I hope that everybody will be provoked at least once in the course of doing this. I think the first theme, inevitably, is that this is a remarkable story. Whether you judge it favorably or unfavorably, you go from a Jewish community of 20 to 25,000, mostly indigent people, to a modern nation of over 9 million, from a situation where 0.3%, a fraction of 1%, of the world's Jews are living in what's usually defined as Palestine. And today we have a situation where 47% of the world's Jews live in Israel, and that clearly will become a majority of the world's Jews within a very few years. It's a nation that's 22nd on the UN Development Index, measure of social well-being, third in the world in university degrees per capita, and first in the world in scientific papers per capita. A creditor nation with half of its exports in high tech, and with more startups in the electronic world, absolutely, than any other country. All of this came with costs, and we'll get to that, but that's clearly the first theme that hits you as you look at this story as a whole. The second theme was that all this took place against the grain of Jewish history. We're going to go back to the Bible here. You may recall Balaam's blessing of the Jewish people as a people that dwells alone, not reckoned among the nations. Well, this is, of course, seen as a template of Jewish history, the diaspora, living in exile, living on the margins of other civilizations, with the irony, the exquisite irony, that while dwelling alone, in fact, Jews had one of the most interactive histories with other peoples of any people. And for this reason, sometimes Balaam's blessing is referred to as Balaam's curse. So what happened in the late 19th century? Two things. One is the appearance of the model of the nation state and the rise of nationalism as a basis for statehood. And the second, related to that, is the Jews were excluded in this new order. And anti-Semitism moved from being more religious to racial and ethnic. The student Theodor Herzl in Vienna, who tried to join, or did join actually, a German nationalist fraternity, was forced out. Jews were not accepted in this new order. And this was particularly critical in Russia, where half the world's Jews lived at the time, with the outbreak of pogroms, a Russian word, in 1881. So the answer that most Jews reached was that Jews had to assimilate in the new order, but they needed to do so as a nation. And for a model, they had to return to antiquity, where there also is a biblical template. In Deuteronomy, I will set a king over, like as all the nations about me, to be a people like other people. And the end result is one of the few cases in the modern world of a people speaking the same language, practicing the same religion, in the same space as that those languages and religions existed 2,000 to 3,000 years ago. But getting there involved a revolt against Jewish history, what's referred to as Shlilat HaGola, the negation of the diaspora, and oftentimes expressed as a revolt against Jewishness itself. One of the early pioneers, A.D. Gordon, says, "We are a parasitic people. We have no roots in the soil. So, of course, we are nothing in the eyes of other people either." Or Josef Chaim Brenner, the poem of Zionism, early Zionism. "With a burning and passionate pleasure, I would blot out of the prayer book of the Jews of our day, thou hast chosen us in every shape and form." The Jews of this period had enough of dwelling alone. They felt it was a time to be like other nations. This required having a homeland like other nations. The third theme is that this vision had no role for others who were living in the chosen homeland. Now, unlike classical colonialism, with which Zionism was sometimes classified, the early Zionists had no plan to exploit, convert, or otherwise shape the resident population of Palestine. Their presence there was basically irrelevant to the program that the Zionists were trying to carry out. But once the early settlers arrived in the Palestinian provinces of the Ottoman Empire, it was inescapable the fact that 95% of the population were Arabs. The answer was that this population would become sort of incidental beneficiaries of the Zionist enterprise. Eliezer ben Yehuda, who's credited with the revival of the Hebrew language as a spoken language, encapsulates this answer to the problem in a few days in his diary upon entry into the Ottoman Empire in 1881. On the first day, he records, "My first meeting with our cousins Ishmael was not a joyous meeting for me." And he realizes that he, at that point, is the stranger there. But days later, a few days later, in the same diary, he encapsulates within a few days a process that took most people much longer. He wrote, "I found a little comfort regarding the general position of the Arabs in Eretz Israel, that it is very lowly. This fact was for me the first ray of light since the moment my foot trod on the land of our fathers." In other words, for Ben Yehuda, the lowly position, as he saw it, of the existing population gives a rationale, an additional rationale, to the entire Zionist program. And this becomes the major theme of early Zionist references, or what I call the theory of benefits. And it was tied to their image as Europeans, as people who were bringing the advances of the modern world to the rest of the world. Not as a main mission, it was more or less, as I said, an incidental mission, a byproduct of building their own society there. Now, this obviously applies so long as you see the existing population as individuals rather than as a people with competing and collective claim to the territory. The first serious statement recognizing Arabs as another people with conflicting claims as a people really is Yitzhak Epstein in 1905, which is a full quarter century after the beginning of Zionist settlement, where he writes, "There is in our beloved land an entire people that has been attached to it for hundreds of years." And Epstein calls for a negotiation nation to nation, which was not accepted at the time. And part of the response also was to deny that there was a problem here with Arab opposition to Zionism. This involved minimizing the evidence of Arab opposition from the very beginning. And from the very beginning, as I've written in another book, there were numerous attacks on all the new settlements beginning in Petah Tikva already in 1886. The fourth theme was that the growth of the Yishuv was sustained by persecution. Every time momentum began to lag, every time there was a lapse, a new wave committed to the settlement was brought about by persecution in different places. In the first wave from the early 1880s, I came across a very, I think, eloquent quote from one of the law students in Kharkov in Russia. He wrote, "With my own eyes, I saw the terrible tragedy in one of the more beautiful and enlightened cities. When I saw all this, something in me snapped. In one flash, all my illusions were revealed, and all the beautiful pictures of the future that I and my friends had painted for ourselves dissipated like smoke." The young professionals in Russia who just enjoyed the privilege of attending universities with the reforms of Alexander II suddenly had the rug pulled out from under them. And so then they became the first wave of refugees finding their way into Palestine. And in the first 25 years, they doubled the Jewish population there, although again, this would have remained a footnote in history, except for what came later. What came later was a resurgence of persecution in Russia, beginning with Kishinev in 1903. And I would just mention the very eloquent poem by Chaim Nachman Bialik, "And cursed be the man who cries avenge. No such revenge. Revenge for the blood of a little child has yet been devised by Satan." So this is the second Aliyah, the second wave, which again doubles the Jewish population. They lose some ground during World War I when the Ottomans expel many Jews who did not have Ottoman citizenship. But the Russian Civil War after World War I sent a third wave. This is, of course, now the period of the British Mandate. And when Russia shut its gates in the 1920s, a fourth wave came because of anti-Semitic persecution in the new state of Poland, and a fifth wave in the 1930s in response to the rise of fascism and Nazism in Europe. And then came the Holocaust. The question historians ask is, would Israel have emerged without the Holocaust? You have to remember that in the British White Paper of 1939, there was to have been no Jewish state. Jewish population in the Mandate of Palestine was limited to one-third of the total population. And without the World War and its results, and had the British remained, in fact, as mandatory power, I think it's a very legitimate question about whether Israel would have ever come into existence. After the creation of Israel, of course, you have the exodus of whole communities from the Arab world, again, as refugees from persecution. Between 1948 and 1972, a total of 800,000, three quarters of whom find their way to Israel. The reality is that Israel is a nation of refugees with worldviews shaped by this very searing experience. 1951 international statute defines refugees as people with a well-founded fear of persecution because of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group or political opinion. By my own rough estimate, roughly 80% of those entering first the Palestinian provinces of the Ottoman Empire, then the Mandate, and then the State of Israel qualify as refugees by this definition, meaning that today's population of Israel are 80% refugees or descendants of refugees, with the bitterness and the insecurity, and what I've labeled actually as the Gewalt syndrome, the ability to extract gloomy premonitions from any state of affairs. Fifth theme is a huge gap between the framework that the early Zionists established and later arrivals. As indicated, the earliest pioneers were very ideological, influenced by socialist currents in Russia, largely secular. They were engaged in a revolt against Jewish history, trying to make the Jews into a normal people. But this framework was filled in the later Aliyot, the later waves of immigration, by whole communities that were more traditional, more religious, more, in quotes, Jewish. going back to more dwelling alone with an emphasis on the distinctive. The big turning point here was the election of 1977, which some scholars have defined as the breakthrough of society, where government reflects the reality of the underlying society. One observer put it this way: the diaspora was returning uninvited to the house which Zionism built. Refugees from Muslim countries, or Mizrahim, about half of the Israeli population, moved clearly to the right politically. Refugees from the former Soviet Union, beginning in the 1970s, another 20% of the population, further tipped the balance. The result of this is that in all elections but two since 1977, parties of the right and religious together have had a majority. There were two exceptions, 1992 and 2006, but other than that, the right and religious together have had a majority in every single Israeli election. The sixth theme is that despite appearances, the Israeli-Palestinian gap has actually narrowed over time. You have to see this in perspective. Initially, back in the 1880s, neither side saw that there was another side. Another side, in fact, to the that there was a conflict with another collective nation or people with collective rights or claims to the territory. The Jews saw Arabs as individuals who would benefit from Jewish settlement, and the Arabs saw Jews as a religion or as settlers who really, from their point of view, were European colonialist intruders. During the mandate, the two sides were forced to see each other, but without making any major concessions, at least until 1937, when the Jewish leadership accepted the recommendation of partition suggested by the Peel Commission of that year, the first time either side leadership had in fact accepted a compromise framework for resolving the conflict. The Arabs at that point rejected this. They saw Palestine as an integral part of the Arab nation, as a majority entitled to self-determination, and again, Jews mainly as a religion. This was true also in 1948 when the United Nations took up the conflict and it expanded to the Arab states. After 1967, the Arab states and Israel accepted Resolution 242 as a basis, and we're not going into detail. 242 does at least imply an Arab acceptance or acceptance by the Arab states of the existence of the State of Israel. In any event, the 67 war was for Israel a de facto end to the existential threat and the beginning of a process of disengagement of the Arab states, which we've seen the fruits of in the last year or two with the Abraham Accords, but we have to remember it's a process that's been in development since 1967, and that before the four states in the Abraham Accords, we had two bordering states, Jordan and Egypt, which had signed peace treaties with Israel. Well, in 1993, for the first time, we had mutual recognition between the two core parties to the conflict in the Oslo Declaration and the agreed framework there. Though it was not explicit, it's hard to see how the Oslo process could lead to anything other than the existence of two states, a two-state solution to the conflict. And this seemed to be confirmed in 2009 when Prime Minister Netanyahu confirmed a very conditional, but nevertheless clear, acceptance of the principle of a two-state solution. You could say it's not been pursued by Netanyahu or Likud since, but nevertheless, it remains formally on the table. And the argument, of course, is made by most parts of the Israeli political spectrum that Israel could remain Jewish and democratic only without the West Bank and Gaza. So we've had face-to-face serious negotiations over the basic issues of the conflict only three times. And this begins 120 years after the onset of the conflict with Camp David in 2000-2001, Camp David Taba. The second time between Olmert and Abbas in 2008-2009, and the third, the Kerry mission in 2013-14. And the whole process has been stalled since the turn of the century, especially after Hamas takeover of Gaza in 2007. The Jewish settlements, the population of the Jewish settlements within in the West Bank has tripled since 1995. In perspective, it took half a century to concede the other side's existence and to discuss compromise. Another half century before the established leadership reached the stage of mutual recognition and a agreed framework for resolution. So it should have perhaps not be a surprise that it's taking another half century to work out the details. The seventh theme, I would suggest, is that Israel is not immune to the forces of modernization and secularization that take place in the industrialized world of which it is now a part. Despite the reassertion of tradition that I've talked about since the election of 1977, there are other forces pushing Israel again to be a nation like other nations. It's increasingly a part of the world economy. Foreign direct investment in Israel has grown 300 times over since 1992. Let me repeat that. Foreign direct investment in Israel has grown 300 times over since 1992. It's also tied in technologically and culturally with the outside world, the internet. I have friends living on a kibbutz in Israel who watch Fox News on cable. Economically, Israel's GDP is now over $400 billion a year. In other words, a total of which U.S. aid today comprises less than 1% of Israel's annual gross product. And private aid to Israel even less than that, of course. Now, it's said that Israel's becoming more religious. The religious families tend to be larger. And if you use fertility rates alone, there's a good basis for saying that, but the figures do not bear it out. In fact, the percentage of Israelis who identify as religious, dati in Hebrew terms, is about the same today as it was in 1979. 1979, it was 17%. Today, it's 21%. Figures from the religious schools, again, there's four educational networks in Israel, and the government networks, two of them, one religious and one secular. And the figures there indicate a steady shift of movement from the religious schools to the secular schools. Other polls show that half of those raised Orthodox in Israel do not remain Orthodox. What has happened is that within the religious community, the Haredim, that is the ultra-Orthodox, have become much more prominent and much more important. The office of chief rabbinate has been more or less taken over by the ultra-Orthodox, the Haredim, over the last 20 or 30 years. So we end up again with a struggle between the identity as Israelis, trying to be a nation like other nations, or as Jews who again pursue the career as a separate people. So how do Israelis in fact identify themselves? We have a survey by Sami Smucha from 2019 that gives a fairly good picture of this. In the survey, only 2.9% identified as Jewish and not at all Israeli. Those obviously would come from within the Haredi community. Only 5.1% say that they are totally Israeli and not at all Jewish. They come, of course, from the other side of the spectrum. The vast majority feel both identities. 48.5% define themselves as mainly Jewish, but also Israeli to some extent. 38.5% is mainly Israeli and also Jewish to some extent. Thus, about 90% of Israelis feel the pull of both templates, both identities. The tension between dwelling alone and being a nation like other nations continues to be a defining feature of Israeli society and politics. And I'll stop with that. I'm ready for discussion.
All right. Well, thank you, Alan, for that recapping of the of Jewish history, to where we are now, and to the creation, which is obviously very valuable, and I think obviously critical to those of us who are in the space to know what's going on. And you know, we see a lot of the lack of understanding of the historical narrative. I thank you for that. So the floor is now open, as I said before, if you have questions, please feel free to raise your virtual hand and I'll be able to unmute you, or type in your question in the chat. Alex, why don't you start us off, and then we'll take it from there.
Sure. So thanks very much for the presentation, very concise, and it raises a number of issues, or a number of questions for me. But I'll focus in on one, and you mentioned the impact of Mizrahi and then much later Russian immigration on Israel, particularly on politics, and I think it could be said on identity. Obviously, the Mizrahim came in large numbers, hundreds of thousands in short periods of time. But what about the Anglos? What about English-speaking immigrants and their political, cultural, and identity impact over the years? Now, while you were speaking, I looked it up again just to confirm that in the entire history of the state, there have been something like 120,000 American immigrants, ranging from a few hundred a year to a few thousand coming per year, as opposed to something like 150,000 Iraqis, all of whom came within a decade or less. So any thoughts about that?
Well, I don't have any data right here at my fingertips. Obviously, the figure that you said 150,000, that sounds about right. But that's over the entire history of Israel, which is, of course, now even just in 48, over half a century, 70 years. So numerically, it's not been a big impact. And I think another reason for that is that it was, I think in recent years, it's been largely or disproportionately from the more religious part of the population. But as a whole, it probably pretty well distributed across the political spectrum. So I don't think you can point to any particularly strong impact that North American immigration in itself has really had. I mean, we have the earlier contributions to labor Zionism. Golda Meir is a big symbol of that. As I said, my understanding is, and I don't have the figures, but my understanding is in recent years it would be much more predominantly on the religious side.
Well, I think my point, though, is that Anglos who've immigrated to Israel over the course of 70 odd years have not come as refugees, as opposed to Mizrahim and, in their own way, let's say, Russians. And the impact on the broader culture, and which has very direct impact impacts on the politics and the political parties who have been supported, particularly since the breakthrough of the 1970s.
Well, you're right. You're right. I mean, they are not part of that 80% that I talked about. They're part of the other 20% too, who do not come in from a background of fleeing from somewhere else.
Right. Okay. Well, I have more questions, but let's see if there's other folks out there who want to weigh in.
Great. Well, thank you for that, Alex, and we'll come back to you. But let's take a few questions from the audience here that are already coming in. I'm going to try to combine some of them for you, Alan, so you can try to tackle some of them. So our first question is from Cheryl, and she's going back to your stats. She said that you referred to 50% of Israeli Jews that were raised Orthodox do not remain Orthodox. And so in particular, she's asking, in which of those Orthodox community can we see that visibly taking place? And also asking you to kind of take a deeper dive, is that, you know, in the Tilumi community or in the Haredi community, to be more specific as far as the fragmentation of Israeli society?
Well, it's more in the, what would be called the modern Orthodox. In a lot of classifications in Israel, you differentiate between Dati and Haredi, that is just modern Orthodox, or the I don't like the phrase, nobody likes being called ultra, usually translated as ultra Orthodox. The ultra Orthodox, the Haredi community is growing, there's no doubt about that. They project it to be something like 40% within the next 20 years or so, but that's, again, if you just go by fertility figures alone, and obviously that's not a complete picture. But where the statistics on the schools is concerned, that is mainly with the modern Orthodox community. That and this is a poll that was done not too long ago. I can't look it up while I'm speaking, but it's in the book. It's cited in the book. One of the polls taken fairly recently that asked people, you know, who had actually attended the government religious schools, but who had not remained, you might say, observant, as usually defined the Dati part of the population. And that's not unusual. I mean, again, Israel is a modern secularizing state. This is a trend that's true of almost all developed industrialized states. There's a fall off of traditional religion. And Israel is not immune from the same forces that perform this way in other countries. In that sense, it's again part of the pressures to be a nation like other nations.
Right. Great. Thank you for that. I'm going to move on to Richard England's question. Also on those same lines of the societal fragmentation inside of Israel, but he's asking about what are the points of agreement and friction really when it comes to the Mizrahim and the Russians as it relates to Israel. And maybe, you know, I'm taking it one step further. Maybe you want to talk about, you know, how that relates into how they vote, you know, when it comes to, you know, the fragmentation of the Israeli Knesset. You know, maybe you want to talk about, you know, the Lieberman factor, you know, as an example of some of those frictions.
That's a very good point. I put the right and religious together when I cited this, because generally politically they do work together. The current government, of course, is a totally different picture,
right?
Because the circumstances. But yes, I mean the Mizrahi population are disproportionately supporters of Likud, which is a secular party, but I would say more accommodating to religion. I mean, Menachem Begin, people like that, the religious part of the population always felt more comfortable with him than with the labor Zionists. And of course, you do have the religious Sephardi parties, Shas in particular, that reflect the greater traditionalism in the Mizrahi population, many of whom will not particularly observe it and continue nevertheless to support Shas. Now, compare that to the Russians. I mean, the Russian immigration was largely secular, very secular, in fact, but very nationalistic, very, very right-wing. And you have Lieberman and before him Sharansky and the others who typified this approach. And there have been points of friction between Shas on one side, representing a much more religious point, and the recent immigrants from Russia, who some of whom, of course, are not halakhically Jewish and who come into conflict with the religious establishment because of this. So that's been a minor thing, but nevertheless a very, very significant theme lately, and has sometimes caused problems in getting the right and religious parties to work together.
Thank you. No, there's a lot obviously there to tackle and to unpack. I'm going to move on to Charles Feynman's question. I mean, and you know, I guess to your point before, you know, the survey that you were referencing as far as how Israelis define themselves, whether Israelis or Jews, how would you contrast that, you know, to Charles's point with the debate about Jewish identity in the United States today? Obviously, you know, there has been a recent, you know, obviously, the Pew studies that have come out and, you know, and the role of Israel, which used to be more of a kind of a building block factor into Jewish identity and American Jews, and where we're seeing the tension play out now versus, you know, how you've described and looked at the societal fragmentation of Israeli / Jewish identity inside of Israel.
Well, that's an interesting point of comparison, and it's been a concern to some people who tried to analyze this in recent years. I would point to the work of Amos Asael in particular, who wrote for the Jerusalem Post and then has published some thoughts on this, and he expects the Israel to become the Jewish mainland, as he calls it, that it will increasingly define what it means to be Jewish. That is what happens in Israel, both in religious realms and in other realms, as Jews in the United States become more and more assimilated on the whole. And again, this is a source of concern to many people that the bonds will become weaker and so on. There's no sign of that yet. I think one of the figures you come across is that 40% of American Jews have been to Israel and 40% of Israelis have been at least abroad or probably to the United States. So there are a lot of ongoing bonds, connections, ties, links there. But I think it is inevitable that as a majority of the Jews will be in Israel within the foreseeable future, within the near future, and more the content of modern Judaism will be defined in Israel, that it will become the Jewish mainland and that other Jewish communities will be defined in relation to it to some extent. I don't want to overstate it. They'll maintain their own character as well. They won't just become extensions, but it'll become a more complicated relationship. I think many, many people in this country, American Jews, I'm not sure they're ready for this. They realize that the American aid to Israel, as important as it could be in certain respects, that is access to modern military technology in particular, in the overall sense, as I said, it's less than 1% of the Israeli GDP. So that kind of dependence that used to exist there is simply not part of the picture anymore.
Great, thank you. So jumping onto a different hat of yours, Alan, you know, to the question that my friend Neva Basker has, you know, as far as a little bit about, you know, your, you know, Israel studies and what's going on currently in American college campuses. So after the war in Gaza in May, you know, we saw a great deal of critical statement, to say the least, you know, anti-Israel, anti-Semitic statements, you know, criticizing Israel, apartheid, genocide, and whatnot, that many individuals, in the area of Israel studies signed on to. And so she's asking whether you could comment on the views of teaching on Israel studies, from your long view, in North America today.
Well, the field of Israel studies reflects the divisions that exist in the Jewish community at large and in the academic community at large, both. And when I was active in the leadership of the Association for Israel Studies, my goal was to have a big tent in which people could discuss these things civilly within the same framework. And I think by and large we managed to do that in the framework of AIS, which at one time did disproportionately represent a particular approach, but I think today is, you could say it's pretty much a big tent. Now there are some elements, some people within the field of Jewish, of the Israel studies, who are much more critical than that. And generally speaking, they don't find themselves comfortable in a setting like AIS. And there are other smaller organizations. The growth of the BDS movement has posed a real challenge on many campuses, because it's easy for some people to make a quick analogy between the situation between Israel and the Palestinians and other situations, post-colonialism in various places. And so BDS has become a kind of very appealing idea to some people who come up there from that critical point of view. I don't subscribe to it. I think there are important differences, but this is going to be a challenge in the academic world because of the existence of models that seem to fit.
Great, thank you for that. So along those same lines, and obviously that's a whole other topic to discuss, as far as what we're seeing in the academy, and of course many of us here are involved in that thing, so these are, things that some of our members are observing on their own campuses and their own communities. But going back to your book, I'm going to jump to Paul Crossley's question here. So based on the seven indicators that you went through, he is asking, if you're able to kind of make any critical challenges that we're going to see over the next 30 years, based on what you've identified now in this first part, kind of looking at where Israel, from its formation to where we are now, 70 plus years later. But are there any of these indicators looking at challenges that we're going to see looking forward that we should be looking out for, or looking at as far as how to look at the entire Zionist enterprise?
Well, yes. I mean, I think some of these are kind of implicit from what I've said already. I mean, as Israel adjusts to its role in the modern industrialized world, it's going to inevitably lose. I mean, people are so intertwined now together. You see sanctions being carried out against various countries that are really much more effective than they used to be, because countries are more interconnected. So Israel is going to have to be more sensitive on these issues. If the European Common Market refuses to import goods that are made in what they consider to be the occupied territories, this could, could be entree to even more challenging ideas. On the more political side of this, I'll boldly go where some have gone before. If there is not a two-state solution somewhere in the near future, then the anomalies of the current situation are going to increase and increasingly complicate the situation. We thought we were on the road to this in the late 1990s, and Then Hamas took over in Gaza, and frankly, as long as the Palestinians haven't gotten their act together and they have a unified leadership that's engaged in the two-state solution, then it really isn't possible. But I think this is the real challenge that exists, to keep the possibilities open, because without a Palestinian state alongside of Israel, this problem will remain and fester over time, it seems to me.
Great. So let me, just keeping my eye on the clock here. Let's go to Jack's question, Jack's McKay's question. So Jack is asking, about how much did the role of individual personalities play into Israeli history as opposed to the larger forces as far as religion and persecution? And I'm adding here, maybe, you want to use that as a kind of a case study of the Netanyahu factor, and what we've seen over the past few years in Israel and leadership and whatnot. So I guess personalities versus, the larger trends, if you can touch on that.
Well, that's about as difficult a question as can be posed here. And I think anybody who's tried to practice history over the years,
I know you're good at it, Alan. So I can throw those questions.
Thank you. My tendency is to always focus on the larger forces. The personalities always seem more important at the time because they're dramatic. They're and people relate to people and so on. So it's easy to point to things that seem decisive, and then maybe in broader perspective, maybe not quite so decisive. But I would say, for example, the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin was definitely an event involving a particular individual whose role was at that point irreplaceable. What would have happened if he had just put on his desk the agreement in principle for a two-state solution the week before he was assassinated? And would the elections that next year have turned out differently if he had been at the head of the ticket instead of Peres? I mean, these are legitimate questions. As far as Netanyahu is concerned, I don't know in the long run he's going to be considered decisive, but he certainly was the focus of a lot of things. And it's hard to imagine the current government being put together without their common opposition. I mean, this is kind of backward thing, more like a negative than a positive, but the one thing that pulled these other right-wing parties into a coalition with an Arab party was their common opposition to Bibi as a person. For better or for worse, I mean, this was definitely a factor in these negotiations. Now, maybe that in 10 or 20 years, this won't look important. Maybe this government will last out its full term in office, maybe it won't, but certainly its formation had something to do with the role of a particular individual, negatively or positively. There are certainly key personalities, and I haven't talked about Ben Gurion, of course, if you want to go back there, but one is always trying to weigh these things, but you have to sometimes gain perspective to take the long-term view in order to really decide whether a personality had all that much influence or not.
Right. And obviously, to your point about Ben Gurion, I mean, there obviously have been a lot of historical questions about, the founding fathers and the younger emerging leaders. Are they able to bring together the nation? Obviously, Israelis have been able to test out their democracy and try elections, four times, five times, as many as they can try to actually, bring it all together. And also a trend that maybe, is worth looking at as far as the smaller parties, the leadership, and been able to, bring this country together under one, in contrast to our two-party system?
Well, let me just offer one thought on that, and that is that they always used to say, Israeli politics didn't have a middle. Centrist parties historically, were never very successful. They were usually one-shot affairs. I mean, right. You had Yigal Yadin, who appeared in, one or two elections, and then his party disappeared and so on. But in recent elections, we've had more of a serious center in Israeli politics, and looked at in terms of overall stability and unity and so on, that's probably a good thing. That is, it's not as polarized as it used to be in the heyday of labor Zionism. And it's much less complicated to build a coalition that most people can identify with. My God, the current coalition, almost everybody can identify with some part of it, at least.
at least one person.
Yeah, from one exactly. end of the spectrum to another, you've got somebody you can identify there. So that's not a bad thing.
Great. Well, Alan, I'm just, keeping an eye on the clock here. So I really, unfortunately our time is coming to an end, but I really want to thank you for taking the time today to join us and to talk about your latest research and the book. I want to thank the audience for joining us this afternoon. I apologize for not getting to everybody's questions, but if you have other questions, please feel free to email us after the session. I urge everybody to pick up Alan's new book and his other books, all very wonderful historical resources that are needed, in everybody's library if they want to learn about these topics and very critical issues as Israel evolves and looking at American foreign policy towards the Middle East and Israel at large. Please be on the lookout for further notices for our next webinar next week. I want to thank Alan again for joining us. I want to thank, as always, Alex Jaffe for helping me moderate the conversation. And we look forward to seeing you at our next program.
My thanks to you and to everybody who has been with us.
Thank you so much, Alan. And we look forward to seeing you on the future program. And we will talk soon.
Okay.
Take care.